My first episode of an arrhythmia woke me up when I was asleep at home, and I felt very unwell, dizzy, and my heart was going at about 200 beats per minute, and I really felt unwell. I waited a few minutes to see if it settled, and I realized what I had, and so my wife called an ambulance, and they took me to hospital. And I saw the ECG, and this was the first thing that worried me, because I thought that I had a particular sort of arrhythmia, being a doctor, which was atrial flutter. And the doctors said I had a supraventricular tachycardia. You treat them in completely different ways. So I felt that they were giving me the wrong treatment. So that wasn't a brilliant start, but after about 2 hours, I went back into ordinary sinus rhythm. That's normal heart rate. And they observed me overnight and sent me home the next day. And I actually went to work the next day because I was feeling fine. And that's often the way in which atrial fibrillation, as it turns out, presents. On a positive note, they arranged for me to see a cardiologist, and I saw a cardiologist who didn't look at my ECG properly, so I was not impressed with him. He did put me onto some medication that I didn't think was the right one for me, so I did some investigations. Again, as a doctor, I'm in a position to be able to do this. I think if you're a lay person, this might be a bit more difficult, but maybe your GP will do this for you. And I asked to see a different doctor for a second opinion, and this doctor actually read my ECG properly and told me what I'd already knew, which was that I had atrial flutter followed by atrial fibrillation. The difference between atrial fibrillation and atrial flutter is quite subtle. They originate in different bits of the heart. So the conducting tissue, which are the nerves that tell the heart how to beat and when to beat. So when you're sitting down, your heart beats more slowly. When you're exercising, it beats faster so that the tissues can get more oxygen. Basically, with these arrhythmias, the conducting tissues and what are called nodes, which are bits of the heart where you have a whole group of nerves that tell the heart to beat, are just not functioning. And the problems are either in the node itself, and then you have a particular sort of arrhythmia, or in all of the conducting tissue, that's all the nerves that take the message that the heart needs to contract. And with atrial fibrillation, the node is actually not in the heart, it's in the pulmonary vein, which is just above the heart. And then there are nerves that connect it to the rest of the heart. So essentially with atrial flutter, you have a very specific localized problem that makes the heart beat very fast. But it originates in the small chamber called the atrium on the top of the heart. With atrial fibrillation, you have a problem with all of the conducting tissues, and therefore the issue is much more generalized, and the rhythm tends to be more irregular and usually a little bit slower. So those are the differences. But you can have a mixture, and with me, I presented with atrial flutter, and then I went into atrial fibrillation, which is not unusual. We treat atrial fibrillation because it causes strokes as well as the symptoms related to having an arrhythmia. And in the past, it was quoted that about 10% of strokes were caused by atrial fibrillation. As we get better at treating high blood pressure, which we are, that figure's now gone up to about 30%. In other words, it's becoming a much more common cause of strokes, not because it's increasing, it's because other strokes are decreasing, if that makes sense. And when people have strokes from atrial fibrillation, it's usually because they get a clot in something called the atrial appendage, which is a small muscular compartments next to the atrium, the left atrium, that fills up with clot because it doesn't beat very hard. And the beating actually means that clot doesn't happen. If the heart is beating irregularly, you're much more likely to develop clot on the lining of the heart, and the atrial appendage beats less than any other bit of the heart, so it's more likely. So they think that 90% of strokes come from clot in the atrial appendage. So if someone is at very high risk of stroke and they can't tolerate blood-thinning drugs like warfarin, then one of the things they can do is they can destroy the atrial appendage, which is another treatment. What triggers are there for myoarrhythmias? Well, essentially, the natural history of these sorts of atrial problems is that they tend to get worse, and I started out and still have something called paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. Paroxysmal is a fancy medical word for things that come and go. So initially I would have episodes of atrial arrhythmia, perhaps about 5 or 10 minutes once every couple of weeks. And then over the 5 years, it ended up with me being in arrhythmia about half the time. But people have different patterns, and some people will suddenly go into atrial fibrillation permanently, and you need to work out why. Usually we don't know why, but sometimes it's associated with an overactive thyroid gland, sometimes it's associated with untreated high blood pressure, and occasionally it's associated with other things like blocked coronary arteries, that's ischemic heart disease, which leads to heart attacks, and rarely with things called cardiomyopathies, where the muscle of the heart just doesn't work properly. And most commonly of those, they're all rare, something called dilational cardiomyopathy, where the chambers of the heart get quite big and the muscles get stretched and the nerves get stretched, and then they don't work properly. My atrial fibrillation often comes on in the middle of the night for no good reason. It always is sensitive to red wine, so I've cut out red wine. That's very common because red wine contains amphetamine-type drugs, tyramine and things like that, that make the heartbeat faster and can precipitate arrhythmias. People need to work out for themselves what causes or what might bring on their arrhythmia. And initially I found that I could put myself back into normal heart rhythm by lying on my left side, but if I laid on my right side, I was more likely to get an arrhythmia. So it's a sort of trial and error. You find out what your own personal arrhythmia does. And how did it bother me? Well, the main thing was I didn't like it, because I didn't like feeling my heart beating, which is pretty common. And the other major thing for me was that my exercise tolerance went down. So when I was having flutter, I felt really unwell because my heart was beating really fast. And with fibrillation, it was beating less fast, but it was still affecting me. So if I exercised, I just had to take it a bit more slowly. And a lot of folk have that. A lot of people actually don't notice that they have an arrhythmia at all, so, which is one of the issues with this, because if you don't notice it, you don't go and see someone about it. So what happened to me was that I was given treatments, drug treatments, commonly one that stabilizes the nerves so that you're less likely to get an aberrant arrhythmia. These are called antiarrhythmic drugs. Commonest one that's used for atrial fibrillation is one called flecainide. This is an interesting drug because it's very easy to get toxic from it, and it also increases person's risk of sudden death. That means just dropping down dead. So the mortality with the drug is actually not that different from not treating. And that's not an unusual state of affairs with drugs. And then there are a whole bunch of other things. So I was tried on that and it didn't work. I then, because I was still getting regular episodes of atrial flutter, you don't want to leave someone in atrial flutter because you run the risk of actually permanently damaging the heart muscle. And as I said, it's not very nice. I had what was called a flutter ablation quite early on, which I was awake for. And essentially that involves putting cannula into your heart through your groin. And the first one I had was, I was awake, so I was able to watch it all. It was really painful, despite having morphine. Once they got to the heart, putting it into the groin wasn't a big deal, but once it got up into the heart, it was really... And the process was actually damaging heart muscles, so it's a bit like having a heart attack, except for it's induced by the doctors, so it's not surprising it hurts. And nowadays, they tend to do ablations, because that was 5 years ago, with someone asleep under general anaesthetic, which I think is much kinder. So, and I had a flutter ablation, which essentially didn't get rid of my episodes of flutter 100%, but got rid of them 90%, which was good. But I was still getting intermittent episodes of atrial fibrillation. And the hope was that by getting rid of the flutter, they'd get rid of the fibrillation as well, but they didn't. And so I was tried on a range of other drugs, because even when I was having atrial fibrillation, my heart was going pretty fast, between 130 and 160, which the normal heart rate, you really don't want to be above resting 85, 90 beats per minute. I was put on to drugs called beta blockers, which slow the heart down. They have quite complex mechanism of action, but that's how they work. And they're the mainstay of treatment. So if someone is in permanent atrial fibrillation, your objective is to slow the heart down, because if the heart is beating slowly, even if it's irregular, the function of the heart is much better. The faster it goes, the less functional the heart is, and the more damage potentially you can cause. And the other mainstay of treatment is to try and put people back into normal heart rhythm, which is what the antiarrhythmic drugs do. And some of them do a combination. So the old-fashioned drug, which you're interested in, digoxin, does both. So it might put you back into normal rhythm, but it definitely slows the heart down. And it has another benefit, which is if someone has fast atrial fibrillation, and that puts them into heart failure, and that would always presuppose that there was something else wrong with the heart muscle, then digoxin is a fantastic drug for treating heart failure caused by atrial fibrillation. I've been on all of those drugs, and then I was on a different antiarrhythmic drug because flecainide didn't really work that brilliantly for me, propafenone, which was 3 times a day, which is a pain in the taking a drug more than once a day is really not very nice. That, I don't think that did anything. So I was on all of these things, and it still didn't slow my heart rate down. I then spent a number of years taking increasing doses of various drugs to prevent me from having a stroke, because I am young and healthy and at low risk of a stroke. I was initially on aspirin, but I decided that I needed to go on to warfarin about 2.5 years ago. It's a much better drug for preventing stroke. And as you get older, your risk goes up. So I switched over to that. A bunch of arrhythmia drugs didn't really work. The beta blockers did slow my heart down a little bit. And actually, I quite like being on them. They make me feel quite good. They're used for stress and anxiety. That's one, and migraines and stuff like that. And as I was getting more and more episodes of atrial fibrillation and my medication wasn't slowing my heart rate when I was getting it, I finally decided after much deliberation to have a fibrillation ablation. And what was nice is I chose when I was going to have it, and then I chose when it was convenient for me to have it. It was done under general anaesthetic. The procedure lasted 3.5 hours, so it's not an insignificant procedure. And it seems to have helped, although I wasn't that keen on having ablation for a number of reasons. One is it can go wrong. It has a mortality. The death rate relates to actually when you have a fibrillation ablation, what they do is they burn all the nerves between the atrial node, which is in the pulmonary vein, and the heart. So they have to do a big burn around the entire pulmonary vein, or the base of the pulmonary vein, which is a big procedure. And if they do it too much, you get a fistula. That's a connection between the vessel, the pulmonary vein, just above the heart, and the gullet. And that's basically Curtin's. You die from that. You can also, if they do a little bit too much, you can bleed into the lining around the heart. So you get a what's called a tamponade, which is blood in the lining around the heart. And it's a bit like having a double balloon. If you fill up the space between two balloons, then the inner balloon gets smaller, and basically it's like squeezing the heart, and then it doesn't work. So that's pretty nasty as well. But the treatment for that is to drain the fluid off, usually with a big needle. And but it's still potentially fatal. And you can get infections, and finally, the operation cannot work. So the final point is that ablations haven't been around for very long, so we don't know long-term whether they actually work or not. We know that if you're, in terms of working, that they do have a good effect short-term, and by that I mean a few years, of stopping people having regular episodes of fibrillation. The other thing which we know is that the heart nerves change. So one of the reasons why atrial fibrillation gets worse is you develop new nerves which are aberrant. They're wrong. So these nerves are for carrying the irregular heartbeat. And once you've developed those nerves, they're very difficult to get rid of. So once you've been in permanent atrial fibrillation for more than about 3 months, an ablation is much less likely to work. You still have a chance. And that's all to do with these new vessels that grow when you're in permanent atrial fibrillation, which is why the timing of when you do the ablation is quite important. The ablation for flutter is very, very specific. You just burn one bit of conducting tissue. It's a much quicker procedure. It takes about half an hour. Whereas for atrial fibrillation, you have to burn completely around the base of the pulmonary vein, which is quite big. It takes a long time. And you need to do that under ultrasound guidance. And they've got very clever probes now that tell you where you are. So you have a sort of 3D image while the cardiologist is doing it. And you just have to slowly go round and burn. And the anatomy of the pulmonary vein varies from one person to another. So you need, before you do it, you need to have a very clear image of the heart. So most people have an MRI scan of their heart to check out what's going on. And then the cardiologist knows which bit to zap. So those are the differences. The reason why you can burn the atrial node quite happily is that on the other side of the heart, the ventricle, there is another node, the ventricular node, that actually controls the rate of the heart as a response to exercise or stress. So nothing is done to that one. So if I was to do a 10-kilometer cycle, my heart would beat faster because my ventricular node was working properly. So I had the procedure done 7 weeks ago, and since then I've had 2 episodes of arrhythmias, which is not bad going. No, 3 episodes. One of them was immediately after the procedure, and that's another potential side effect of the procedure, because you basically burn nerves and heart tissue, heart muscle, and that in itself is very irritating to the heart, so you can precipitate other arrhythmias by doing that. And I precipitated fast ventricular flutter going at about 200 beats per minute, and I waited 2 days and didn't get better, and that's when they had me in to do a cardioversion, which basically you can do in. They put me to sleep very briefly, put some paddles on me, but they're sticky, not like they you see in telly, and gave me an electric shock. I was asleep, so fortunately, and it worked first time, and it was very good. What was interesting is they didn't tell me about some of the after effects, so I hadn't realised that I was at significant increased risk of having other arrhythmias, which they should have done, because I knew that I had to contact them when that happens, but other people might not have known. Getting more frequent episodes of atrial fibrillation affected me in a number of ways. So the first one is I didn't like it because I could feel my heart beating, and that's a very subjective feeling. Some people cope with that. I just didn't like it very much. Secondly, my exercise tolerance went down. And thirdly, I was not able to concentrate and I was tired when I was in atrial fibrillation. It is really knackering for me. Other people don't find it like that, but I did. And my energy levels were a lot better since I've had fewer episodes. Nobody actually really understands how digoxin works. And it's been around for a very long time. So in the 18th century, it was used for what was called dropsy, which is heart failure, where people retain fluid. And it's quite a good drug for that if the heart failure is caused by atrial fibrillation. It's a completely useless drug if the heart failure is caused by something else. But for many years, it was one of the very few treatments that were around. The side effects, all drugs have got side effects. And I think it's always a balance between, first of all, it's important as a patient to understand what the side effects are so that you can live with them. So beta blockers traditionally reduce your sex drive. That's okay if you know about it, but might come as a bit of a shock if you didn't. Digoxin toxicity has a whole bunch of different problems, including other arrhythmias. You can get disconnection of the heart from the conducting tissues, can affect the kidneys. It's not a fantastically beautiful drug. Flecainide can make you drop down dead. So I could go on, and I'm not going to. I've been really lucky in that I've had almost no side effects. And some of the side effects, like slowing my heart down with a beta blocker, I quite like. So, and it's probably quite good. It drops my blood pressure, which is good anyway. And I've been on digoxin for about 18 months, 2 years, same time period of time as I've been on warfarin. My digoxin levels, because I have my blood level checked. And interestingly, what you have to do, digoxin lasts in the blood for a long time. So when you start digoxin, you need to be loaded up with quite a big dose, and then they check whether your blood levels are in what's called a therapeutic window. If it's too high, you get toxicity. If it's too low, it doesn't work. So mine's been on the low normal side. So I've been upping and downing my dose. So my GP, rather than my cardiologist, and I do this. How often do I need to monitor the digoxin? Essentially, because I'm on warfarin, I get blood checks every month or so. And if I change my medication, and the medication recently following the ablation has been changing, then I will be checked regularly. And I've, after the ablation, because I had this nasty atrial flutter, I was put onto another not very nice drug made by a French drug company called amiodarone, which can seriously affect the functioning of the thyroid gland because it's got iodine in it. And it also blocks liver metabolism of other drugs, including warfarin and digoxin. So all of my medication, the doses were changed, reduced, then put back up again. So to actually do this right is quite complex. How do I view digoxin? Given that I have no side effects from it, and I think it does something, it reduces my heart rate a little bit when I was in AF, I'm quite happy. It's almost certainly going to be the first drug that I stop, because as I said, its role is to reduce the heart rate when you are in fibrillation. And as I'm not getting regular episodes of fibrillation, I probably don't need to be on it. I mean, I've been lucky, I've not had any side effects from any of these. The cardiologist told me that I need to view the ablation as a two-stage procedure. So normally it's done, can be done twice. You have to wait at least 3 months after the first one to see whether it's worked or not. So I'm going to be at 3 months towards the end of January, because up until then you can still get arrhythmias because the heart's tissue's healing. And depending on who you believe, it's between 70 and 90% effective at getting rid of the arrhythmia. What we don't know, what nobody knows, is whether you can stop all your medication. So is the long-term risk of stroke reduced by having an ablation? And the truth is nobody knows, because we haven't been doing... The logical thing would be if you get rid of the arrhythmia, you get rid of the risk of stroke. So what I'm hoping is that there will be a sequential reduction in the number of pills that I take. So I would hope that amiodarone would be the first drug I would want to stop, although I've had a couple of episodes of arrhythmia since I had the ablation, so maybe not. Then digoxin, and if I'm still getting episodes, then I'll have a choice about whether I go back on the amiodarone or have a second ablation. I'm going to stay on anticoagulants till I'm absolutely certain I'm not getting any episodes of arrhythmias, because the reason I'm on these drugs is to stop me from having a stroke, although I'm when I say relatively low risk, my personal risk is 2.5% per year of having a stroke, which is still too much for me. But that's reduced by over 70% by being on warfarin. So that's very good. And if I was just taking aspirin, it would only be reduced by 30%. I've had a range of other problems in the past. So I had a pituitary tumour that got excised, and the fibrillation really started after that. And the pituitary tumour produced a hormone that made the heart bigger. And I think the two things were related, personally, although, again, there's no evidence for that. So in terms of how I feel about myself, I don't feel sick. I feel completely normal. I have a condition. And this is true for a lot of long-term conditions. It's how you internalize it and think about it yourself, rather than... So you can have someone, and I've got a patient who's got end-stage kidney disease and is still working full-time. You can have someone with exactly the same condition who is psychologically crippled by it. So actually being positive about what you've got and seeing that it can be a good thing rather than a bad thing, I think is quite important. And that it doesn't just apply to me, it applies to lots of people. I know that my particular fibrillation, if untreated with ablation, would have gone permanent. And then I would have had the deal of, do I just live with the symptoms or not, which I probably would have done. And because the course of atrial fibrillation is not 100% clear, you can't predict that in 5 years' time it will be doing this or that, it's quite difficult.